I don't know whether we can,
Wash it good now.
I don't know whether we can get anything out of this thing or not.
What do you mean? Oh, you mean is the batteries are down?
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, and presidents, past and present. My good friend, Mr. Dorn. You know, there's one thing I have been, you can hear, this is the result of meeting in smoke-filled rooms. But you know, there's one line that's been denied me for some time past. I can't open remarks by saying unaccustomed as I am. There is one thing that's new today, however. While it's true that for the past several years I have had some experience with being an after-dinner speaker, I have rarely been one so far after dinner. But I've been protesting the growth of government. Incidentally, in that introduction, I have to say again, I always get a little self-conscious. Kind as you are and undeserving as I am of those remarks, but when you mention that honorary degree my alma mater gave me, because I've always figured for a number of years the first one they gave me was honorary. But I've been protesting for a number of years the growth of government, the permanent structure of government, a problem which I think crosses party lines. And I have expressed concern lest this permanent structure become so big and so complicated as to be virtually beyond the control of Congress and reach a point at which it takes a hand in making policy. This has been quite a constant theme with me in all my the occasions when I am speaking. I've seen an interesting development in these several years. When I first began talking about the danger that was of government control that was inherent in federal helpful hands, I was usually met with vehement denials. There were people who protested that, of course, the government could express the idea of federal aid without meaning federal control. But before too long, a subtle change took place. I could speak on the same subject, and the same people who had opposed me were no longer saying there is going to be no federal control. They were saying, "What's wrong with federal control?" And today, I'm sure many of you have heard the question asked when someone criticizes the invasion by government of a new area: are you afraid of your government? Well, to tell you the truth, I am. And I think all of us should be. I think we should be afraid of all government. This was the admonition of the founding fathers over and over again, that government, any government, tends to grow, tends to increase its power until eventually freedom is lost. The truth is that only government is capable of tyranny. Now, these warnings have come down to us from representatives of every party and every shade of political thinking in our country. We heard them from Jefferson, from Madison, from Woodrow Wilson. We heard a warning a few years ago from a United States senator who said, "The scarlet thread running through the thoughts and actions of people all over the world is the delegation of a great number of vital problems to the all-absorbing Leviathan, the state. Every time that we try to lift a problem to the government, to that same extent, we are sacrificing the liberty of the people." And that senator was John Fitzgerald Kennedy. Now, I realize this is a controversial subject, but then everything is a controversial subject. You know, there was a man knocked on a door one day, and a small boy answered the door, and the man says, "Your father here?" And the kid said, "No." And he says, "Your mother here?" And the boy said, "No." Kind of nonplussed, the man stopped, and then he said, "Well, son, I'm your uncle on your mother's side, or your father's side." And the kid said, "Well, I guess you can come in, but I'll tell you right now, you're sure as hell on the wrong side." But because so much of government growth has been concerned with welfare problems, there's been a tendency of many to accuse others of lacking in humanity if they even so much as question the omnipotence of the welfare state. Now, we can view the so-called conservative today as a reactionary who's opposed to all change and progress. And likewise, we can view the liberal as a bleeding heart who would sacrifice all freedom for to satisfy the material needs of the less fortunate. And I'm sure that these descriptions fit some people among us. But I am equally sure that the majority of us fall somewhere between these two viewpoints, that there is a ground where I think we should be able, without bitterness, to discuss what price in freedom we are willing to pay for security. Well, I'm free to admit that I feel great alarm at the extent to which we have endangered freedom in this country in an attempt to satisfy some very real needs in the area of security. 100 years ago, England's Lord Macaulay wrote a letter to an American friend. He didn't look too kindly on this republic of ours. And in this letter, he told his friend, in the 5th century AD, Rome was fearfully plundered by the Vandals and Huns. He said, in the middle 20th century, your republic, and this is the approximate period we're in, he said, your republic will be fearfully plundered. But with this exception, Rome's barbarians came from without her borders. Yours will have been engendered by your own democratic institutions. Now, perhaps what he had in mind was a statement that has been made, and I have quoted it, and perhaps many of you have heard me quote it often. I think it bears repeating, a statement by a noted historian who commented on democracy, and he said it cannot exist as a permanent form of government. He was talking of outright pure democracy. He said it can only exist until the voters discover they can vote themselves largesse out of the public treasury. From that moment on, the majority always votes for the candidate promising the most benefits from the treasury, with the result that democracy always collapses over a loose fiscal policy, always to be followed by a dictatorship. Now, the significant thing about this that makes it quotable is not that the professor was commenting about our present trend toward the welfare state. The professor made this statement while we were still colonials of Great Britain, and he was explaining what had destroyed the Athenian Republic more than 2,000 years before in that first experiment in the area of democracy. We live in a kind of a schizophrenic world. We live in unprecedented ease and prosperity, but somehow it's hard to accept that we're on the broad highway speeding ever onward and upward. Instead, I think many of us, while we're enjoying this ease, are troubled by a suspicion that we're experiencing the exhilaration of a toboggan ride and we're not quite sure what's around the next bend. Now, we have ended a few weeks ago the fiscal year, and we increased, as we did so, the debt limit for the fifth time in 4 years. We know that our gold supply is so diminished that there is fear for the solvency of our currency. It seems like just a few weeks ago, or a few months ago at most, that I was saying that foreign dollar claims were $27 billion against our gold, and we only had about $14.5 billion. Well, now it's $29 billion, and we're down to $13 billion in gold. The cost of living, particularly for foodstuffs, is at an all-time high. But the farmer who produces those foodstuffs is receiving the lowest percentage of the market basket dollar that any farmer has ever received in history. We pretend we're at peace, but a few Americans die each day. And as far as they're concerned, it must be total war. We move toward the welfare state and an unprecedented federalization of American life. We see our own state governments, and particularly here in California, gradually abandoning the sovereignty of the state. We see government so concerned here in our own state with becoming a little brother to big brother that they're content to relegate the state government to the role of just an administrative district for the federal government. Subsidies proliferate and security becomes so all important as to override self-reliance and self-respect and even simple morality. And now serious discussion appears in the public print. My supposedly learned men granted to the idea of not only helping those in need, but of actually divorcing income from the need to work, with a central authority satisfying not only the needs of the people, but the wants. Well, another philosopher, de Tocqueville, and again about 100 years ago, warned that such a government would cover the face of society with a network of small, complicated rules, minute and uniform. And he said, thus the will of man is not shattered, but softened and guided until man is reduced to a flock of timid and industrious animals of which government is the shepherd. Well, I think at first hearing, most of us would prefer to deny that we're even within distant gunshot of such an alteration of our free way of life. But I wonder if our complacency is justified. Freedom isn't spelled with an S. It isn't divisible. You cannot elect to give up a freedom and keep another freedom. Either you are free or you are not free. But freedom is very fragile, and mankind has only known a few moments in his long climb to the present heights we've reached. But freedom is also very fragile. Most of these moments of freedom have been ours. But now our limited government, with its decentralized powers, has given way to planners who've laid an increasingly heavy hand on every facet of our lives. Sometimes, as I survey their efforts, I think if all of them were laid end to end, they wouldn't reach a conclusion. Once in this country, we had a system of checks and balances. Well, we've still got plenty of checks. They're coming bigger and more often, but we've lost our balance someplace along the line. If we ever decide we need a new Declaration of Independence, I hope we keep one line from the old one. He has sent hither swarms of officers to harass our people and eat out their substance. Federal employees outnumber state employees in 30 of the 50 states, including our own. In spite of the fact that, and this isn't easy in our own state either, because in the last couple of years, we've added 50,000 new employees in just the last few years. As a matter of fact, our state of California has increased during a period when we've doubled our population. We have increased state expenditures 10 times over. We have multiplied the workforce of the state 4 times over. Our federal government, competing with private enterprise in government-owned businesses, has lost $81 billion, more than a fourth of the national debt, and hardly a recommendation for those who say that the government should take an even greater hand in managing the nation's economy. It is estimated that 35% of the businessman's time is taken up with filling out government forms and regulations. It is also estimated that this paperwork by the government costs American industry $20 billion a year. And they're taxed for an additional $7 billion a year for the government end of handling this paper. And there's a threat of even more regulation and a greater takeover. Looms ever larger. Robert Weaver, Federal Housing Administrator, has recently made a public statement that in the beginning, our government turned over the land to the people to speed its development. But he says the policy of the government now is to regain complete control of the use of the land. And we see an example of this down in the Imperial Valley, and again, no voice is raised in Sacramento protesting this. Here are farmers who had a private irrigation district set up, and the federal government asked permission to join them, and in return signed a contract that they would never be subject to the 160-acre limitation for receiving irrigation water. And now those farmers, after 30-odd years, have just been informed the contract doesn't count anymore. They've been ordered by January 1st, reduced to 160 acres. Louis Levine, the United States Director of Employment, says the ultimate goal of his agency is to make it the employment agency for the nation, that he sees no reason why there should continue to be private employment agencies. Every businessman could tell his own story of harassment. Are we safe in our books and records? Well, the post office has just admitted to a congressional committee that they've been turning over private letters, mail, to the Internal Revenue Service, mail addressed to people who are back or delinquent in the payment of their income tax. Planes equipped with surveying instruments fly over our farms to check whether there's been a violation in planting allotments. If any farmer is found so guilty, he is guilty as charged and fined, and if he doesn't pay the fine, his property is seized and sold at auction. For every dollar that we spent in price stabilization in the farm program in 1948, we are spending $25 today. And with what result? Well, 2 million farmers have been driven to the city in search of jobs. And they tell us 2.5 million more are to go. The farmer is getting, as I observed earlier, 37 cents out of the market basket dollar. And his debt in relation to income is higher than it has ever been, even on the eve of the 1929 depression. $2.86 he owes for every dollar of income he has coming in. Our traditional laws of eminent domain have always recognized the occasional need for the government to take private property upon payment of a fair price. Only if the government can prove that there is a clear and present need that can only be satisfied by this particular piece of property. But now a variety of programs have diluted private rights so that public interest is anything a few of these planners decide it should be. We've adopted an urban renewal program. The original intent was to provide quickly decent housing for every American, eliminating slums. Well, no one disagrees with that humanitarian purpose, but since 1949, in this costly program so destructive of personal liberty, we have really failed, because in a 10-year period, we destroyed 126,000 low-rent dwelling units. We replaced them only with 28,000 higher rent units, and we have almost 1 million people displaced and living in new slums at higher rent. The law says the displaced must be offered standard housing at rents they can afford in convenient locations. But if standard housing at rents they could afford in convenient locations had already been available, you wouldn't have needed urban renewal. They'd have moved without the bulldozer pushing them out. Meantime, by contrast, while this mere 28,000 federal units were being built, private enterprise was building 27 million dwelling units in our country. Now, let me make it plain. I don't challenge the sincerity, the motive of these people. I know that they only want to help. They are really and truly motivated by humanitarian goals. But they remind me sometimes of a fellow that was riding a motorcycle one day. Young fellow, and the wind was coming through the buttonholes on his leather jacket and making him uncomfortable. So he figured something out. He turned the jacket around, put it on backward. This solved the cold problem, but it restricted his arm motion a little bit. He hit a patch of ice and skidded into a tree. And when the ambulance arrived, the attendants elbowed their way through the bystanders. One of them said, "What happened?" And the bystander said, "We don't know. When we got here, he seemed to be all right, but by the time we got his head turned around straight, he was dead." Now they urge on us a new cabinet post of urban affairs. We have a program now passed to subsidize rent so that a man can live in a house and a neighborhood beyond his means, with his new neighbors being taxed to help pay the difference in his rent. Urban renewal plans will be used in a new way, they tell us, so that all of our tools, from poverty program to education and construction, can be used to create meaningful and livable communities within our cities. Of course, Washington will decide what is meaningful and livable. We have a poverty program, and like charity, it begins at home, and at home in this case is with the bureaucrats who are invested with the power to run this program. Gum Springs, Virginia has just been awarded $74,000, $54,000 for administrators' salaries and $20,000 for the poor. And there's a certain amount of fighting going on about the kitty here in our own community. Mayor of Paterson, New Jersey is upset. He's just discovered the Federal Housing Authority is getting $1,000 a year more than he is. In the youth phase of the program, we're going to salvage young people who have failed to meet their responsibility to prepare themselves for adult life. No one again quarrels with this goal. But during this salvage operation, we are going to pay these young people who have failed a higher rate of pay than we give the young man who puts on a uniform and goes out to defend his country. Congressman Okonski of Wisconsin just recently shocked his fellow congressman when he told of a story of two boys from his district, brothers. One brother is in Vietnam, defending the rest of us for $78 a month. His other brother is a dropout from high school, arrested for beating their own mother, and he is now employed by the poverty program at $200 a month to run a power mower. And the pattern, of course, follows. Here in our own community, we have a hotel to salvage young ladies. The cost? No one challenges again the purpose, but the cost, $7,000 a year for each young lady we're going to help. Well, if we'd have given the $7,000 to their families in the first place, maybe we could have helped their brothers and sisters too, and they wouldn't have been poor. Do we no longer think it's necessary to teach the simple virtues of reward for labor or to repay when we borrow? There's a Rotary Club in a small college town here in California. They've had a fund for some time that they lend to college students in that small college, no interest, and they don't have to pay it back till they get out of school. Just recently, the dean called the Rotary Club and said, if you're not willing to make it an outright gift, we won't need that fund anymore because the government's putting up the money and the students don't have to pay it back. The network of rules grows more and more minute. There's a fellow running an oil station down in the Mason-Dixon line. He's on a highway where the tourists from the north vacationing in the south have to pass and hopefully buy their gasoline. A little triangle of ground between the sidewalk and the driveway. Instead of covering it with gravel, as so many stations do, he planted a few cotton bushes there. And now he has a kind of a gimmick. When they stop for gas, these northern tourists, he picks a cotton bowl from the bush and gives it to them as a souvenir of their visit to the south. He's just been fined by the federal government for planting cotton without an allotment. Now we're going to subsidize art and literature. Two czars at the federal level, and they will decide as they grant millions of dollars each year what is meaningful in art and literature. Now, maybe I'm unduly perturbed, but if they follow the pattern of so much of government subsidy of scientific research, there is concern that maybe... Now, I'm not a scientist, and I don't make any claims to scientific knowledge, but I wonder if we aren't just subsidizing sometimes intellectual curiosity when I discover spending tens of thousands of dollars on a program of research in philology and faunal affinities of fossil bryozoa in the Middle Ordovician through Silurian. Now, the only thing about that I understand is that phrase, in the middle. There, I know who they're talking about. Now, the federal government concerns itself with recreational facilities and our ability to enjoy ourselves in the great outdoors. There is a new booklet by Special Engineering Services Branch of Environmental Engineering and Food Protection of the United States Public Health Service. That isn't the book. That's the agency that puts it out. And this book has 134 pages of profundities. You wonder how we got along without them up till now. For example, if you lay out a campsite, you should provide drinking fountains at such a height that drinking level is convenient for persons using the fountain. Now, wait till you get to the exciting chapters on wildlife. Insects crawling into the ears of outdoorsmen sometimes create painful conditions. I got news for them. It's no fun when it happens indoors. But this isn't all they have to say about wildlife. If your recreational area has a bathhouse intended for the use of both men and women, it should be divided into two parts by a tight partition. Now, you know we'd have never thought of that by ourselves. Professor Teitler's loose fiscal policy is at hand. Our government is spending $260 million a day. That's $10 million a day more than we were spending a year ago. Here in California, it took us 100 years to reach a $1 billion budget, and only 9 years to reach a $2 billion. And it's only taken us 5 years to double that. And you wonder how long they're going to give us to make it eight. Government planned and sponsored inflation, deliberate and intentional, has reduced the dollar in three decades to 35 and a half cents in purchasing power. In the last 20 years, the value of our savings and insurance has been eroded by $190 billion that we've lost just letting the money stay there. My father used to say when I was a boy that what the country needed was a good 5 cent cigar. What this country needs is a good 5 cent nickel. Now, with our gold supply down from 70% of the world's supply to a third since federal aid was started in 1948, we continue a program in which the ink spattered on American embassies in Hate America demonstrations is bought and paid for by the American taxpayer. The taxpayer, that's someone who works for the government without taking a civil service exam. Now, We go along with the hypocrisy. Our State Department pretends that there could be a spontaneous demonstration against us in one of these police states. And each time when the rocks and the ink stop flying, they send a note to the government of this police state demanding that the next time they send more police. I think it'd make more sense and we'd have more self-respect if we let them know that we know what's going on and told them the next time to send a smaller mob. 325,000 dependents of civilian employees are living abroad, adding to the deficit of exchange. But businessmen are asked to do a 180-degree turn, forsake their traditional role of trading in the world marketplace. I say they're asked, but every businessman in America knows in reality they're being told do or else. We're taxed in our food and our drink and our shelter, with the government taking a higher percentage from the productive free economy than any society has ever taken without ruin. Yes, we're told we'll have a $5 billion cut in the excise tax in the coming year, but we'll also have a $3.5 billion deficit. It's only $3.5 billion now. Previously, it was going to be about $5.5 billion. But you see, they reduced it by a bookkeeping trick that would jail the average businessman. It isn't that we had any economy that reduced the deficit this year. They just took a couple of billion dollars of it and applied it to last year's bill, hoping we'll forget that last year we only had a $6 billion deficit, which they've now upped and are calling an $8 billion deficit. And really, when they talk about tax reduction, they're not reducing it, they're rearranging it. They're just shifting it around like the old shell game and applying it someplace else, hoping they can convince us that they're robbing Peter to pay Paul. Well, it's time you and I figured out that Peter has long since been bankrupt. We're robbing Paul to pay Paul, and most of us today are named Paul. People pay taxes. To pretend that you can cut the tax without reducing the burden that causes them is to perpetrate a fraud upon the people. Government is like a baby. It's an alimentary canal with an appetite at one end and no sense of responsibility at the other. Now, in an atmosphere of emergency, the federal government proposes to help us with our public school problems. And again, it claims it'll exercise no federal control. But when competent educators went before the government in Washington and suggested there was nothing that could not be solved in school problems at the local and state level, and did suggest that perhaps the local and the state could be helped if programs were adopted which left some of the money here at the local level without running it through the central government, a Freudian slip occurred, and Francis Keppel, the director of education, said, "You don't understand. Under such a plan, the government couldn't accomplish its social objectives." Its social objectives. Well, if the government's going to build the schools and buy the books and grant the scholarships and make judgments and exert pressure, what if one day that pressure is of a political nature not to our liking? Education is, as we've always known, the bulwark of freedom. But you remove it too far from the community, too far from parental control, and education becomes very simply the prime tool of tyranny. Now, one reason that you as businessmen must involve yourselves in politics is because you can't afford not to. You spend a lot of time and effort in almost every business that I could name, improving efficiency, to increase your profits by even a fraction of 1%. And yet one government act, one increase in tax, one upping of the Social Security tax, one change in zoning, a new regulation, can wipe out all the savings that you've accomplished by your business experience and talent. Mismanagement is as costly in government as it is in business. And when the mistakes are made in government, you, the businessman, pays the bill. Private ownership disappears as private control is lost. Now, if we're men of goodwill, isn't it time for the conservative, so-called, to explain to what extent he believes society is responsible for seeking an end to misery and poverty and disease? How far he is willing to go? What he believes is society's responsibility in this area. But by the same token, shouldn't the liberal state how far he intends to go in regimenting society in an effort to achieve that same purpose? If he really means welfare at any price, then honesty demands that he give the people the right to choose by telling them in advance how far he actually intends to go without seeking to put these programs over on the people piecemeal, step by step, taking freedom away from the people on a sort of installment plan. Daniel Webster said, nothing will ruin the country if the people themselves will undertake its safety. And nothing can save the country if they leave that safety in any hands but their own. You and I must be willing to study the issues, to be aware, to convey the information to family and friends. We must resist the temptation to get a government handout for our community while we're asking for economy in the rest of the country. We have to realize, for example, that the doctor's fight against socialized medicine is our fight, because if you can socialize the doctor, you can socialize the patient. We have to realize that government's assault on investor-owned utilities is eventually an assault on every privately owned business. We have to demand an end to deficit spending. We're faced with the most evil enemy man has ever known, and there's no security any place in the world if there isn't fiscal and economic stability within the United States. In all of history, every time a cultured society has met the less cultured, the barbarian has triumphed. Is man born with certain unalienable rights, or does he exist only by permission of and for the sake of the group? If we accept the collectivist high-sounding phrase, the greatest good for the greatest number, we are then agreeing that 50% of the people plus one can impose anything they want on the rest of their fellow citizens simply because they outnumber them, and not because what they propose is moral or right. And once we accept that, we march toward eternity as soulless freaks of nature, according to the communist dialectic materialism, all just in ranks in a super ant heap. Either the power of society is limited or it is not. We can't have it both ways. Another historian has said, when the freedom the Athenians wished for most was freedom from responsibility, then Athens ceased to be free and was never free again. We've come to our moment of truth. We have to answer whether we've grown soft. We lighted a torch here 200 years ago that said to the world's downtrodden that here at last men had banded together, pledging their collective strength to guarantee the freedom, the dignity, and the rights of even the least individual among them. If that torch goes out, the darkness will destroy the golden hope of mankind for generations to come. If it is our destiny to be the generation that lets that happen, at least let our children and our children's children say of us in the days ahead that we did all that could be done to prevent it. If we do any less, if you and I are unwilling to meet this challenge, then you and I had better spend the next few years thinking what it is we'll tell our children that we found that was more valuable than freedom, because I think they'll want to know. Thank you.